eye. Tossing fire, leaving Babylon trying to escape this futile. In charge, this country jungle is too wild. That's why we got more than two styles. Too adept in the situation, too sharp. And though the road is rocky, I'm ready to try. The next mile, the bridge side to the black man. It's down to the left child. We will survive. It is time to be wilderness. Swimming through the waters of Babylon like a rebel fish. Jungleist, specialist, critical and survivalist. Splitting hell, fight from his lips. Burn the slave driver.
All I see is confusion.
Welcome, listeners, to Time for an Awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, New Media for the New Millennia. This is a history and current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, "My people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge, but we as a people will turn this around." Proverbs 4:7 states, "Wisdom is the principal thing, therefore get wisdom, go by getting it an understanding." Again, welcome to the program this evening with your hosts, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to get involved in the conversation is 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live audio at several locations. You can go to timeforanawakening.com, which is the homepage, and catch the live stream at that location. You can go to www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening, and the live audio will be playing there also. We're streaming at abibitumi.com. That's abibitumi.com/timeforanawakening. They stream from Ghana. Or you can download the TuneIn Radio app to any of your devices. TuneIn Radio is a free radio app. In that TuneIn search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening. There you'll see the icon, and you can stream the program live, even into your car if you had a Bluetooth capabilities or the auxiliary connection. Again, that's Time for an Awakening radio program with the live stream on the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Again, that's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for an Awakening also has a fan page on Facebook and a Facebook search engine. Just type in Time for an Awakening radio program. There you always see interesting content being posted daily by myself or Brother Richard. And do me a favor before you leave that page, just hit that like button. That's Time for an Awakening radio program. With the fan page on Facebook, and Time for an Awakening Media is all also there. Always full of the latest podcasts of the various programs on Time for an Awakening, interesting articles that you can read, download at later times, and share with your friends. Also, check out that Time for an Awakening marketplace and our partnership with the BB Toomey. Always interesting things in the marketplace all the time. Various African language classes on education, economics, social systems, health, and much, much more being taught by professors on both the continent and in the diaspora. So again, make that one of your favorites. Put that in your address bar. That's timeforanawakening.com. Timeforanawakening.com will take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. It's 7:07 here on this Sunday edition of Time for an Awakening, this Sunday, February 11th edition of Time for an Awakening. Our guest scheduled to join us this evening in conversation, author, associate professor in the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland, Dr. Niambi Michelle Carter. The book, America While Black, African Americans, Immigration, and the Limits of Citizenship. Ought to be an interesting conversation with our guest scheduled to join us this evening. We'll be right back to get the program started after a brief word from our sponsors.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency and business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072. Spelled new as in numerous on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening. With your host, Brother Elliot, Sundays, 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m., for podcasting or live program scheduling, hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. It's 7:12 on this Sunday edition of Time for an Awakening. Before I get started with the program this evening, I want to welcome in my co-host, Philadelphia activist and tour guide at the African American Museum here in Philadelphia, 7th and Arch Street, Brother Richard. Is with us, Brother Richard.
Yes, sir, Brother Elliot.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine. You know, things is in transition for me, but all in all, I'm looking. Everything is good, but as usual, I'm definitely looking to engage in our conversation with Dr. Carter because this book and her is phenomenal. But as we have the conversation now. I look at, but I'm really enjoying the argument that she put forth.
You know, your audio broke up just slightly, Richard, but I guess everything ought to be all right. Richard, this conversation we've been having periodically with different guests and when we go into open forum for quite a while now. I'm glad to have our guest join us this evening. But before we bring our guest on, Dr. Nambi Michelle Carter, let me read two passages to the listening audience, because I think it has a lot to do with our conversation this evening. The book, America While Black, African Americans, Immigration and the Limits to Citizenship. You know, this struggle has been going on well over 200 years with our people here on the shores of North America around the issue of citizenship. Let me go back to the 1830 colored conventions. Shortly afterwards, William Whipper, who was an activist from Philadelphia, had a paper called The Colored American. This is what he stated in the March 4th edition of 1837. It says, many would gladly rob us of our name, Americans. Hence, the propriety of the name of our paper, The Colored American, and of the identity of the name of our institutions, in spite of our enemies who would rob us of our nationality and reproach us as exotics. We are written about, preached to, and prayed for as Negroes, Africans, and Blacks, all of which have been stereotyped as names of reproach. And on that account, if no other, are unacceptable. Let us and our friends unite in baptizing the term colored Americans, and henceforth let us be written of, preached of, and prayed for as such. It is a term and one which is above reproach. This was William Whipper's appeal in 1837. Let's fast forward many decades to 1903. With W.E.B. Du Bois and what he said about double consciousness. I'll share that with the listening audience. It says, it is a peculiar sensation, this double consciousness, this sense of always looking at oneself through the eyes of others, of measuring one's soul by the tape of a world that looks on in amused contempt and pity. One ever feels his two-ness, an American, a Negro, two souls, two thoughts, two unreconciled strivings, two warring ideals in one dark body, whose dogged strength alone keeps it from being torn asunder. 1903, Du Bois. And before I go to our guests, let me play something from 1965 and something Dr. King said to our ancestors. And let me play this.
I come here tonight and plead with you. Believe in yourself and believe that you're somebody. As I said to the group last night, nobody else can do this for us. No document can do this for us. No Lincolnian Emancipation Proclamation can do this for us. No Kennisonian or Johnsonian Civil Rights Bill can do this for us. If the Negro is to be free, he must move down into the inner resources of his own soul and sign with the pen and ink of self-assertive manhood his own Emancipation Proclamation. Don't let anybody take your manhood.
Our guest this evening in conversation, author, associate professor in the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland, Dr. Niambi Michelle Carter. Dr. Carter, are you there?
I am here. How are you?
I'm glad to have you join myself and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening.
Thank you for having me so much.
How you doing, Dr. Carter?
I'm doing well.
Dr. Carter, you know, before we get started with our conversation this evening, and you have to excuse me because what I want to do is kind of go in reverse.
Okay.
The title of your book is America While Black, African Americans, Immigration, and the Limits to Citizenship. I want to start first at the rear, the limits to citizenship, and then we'll work up to this issue of immigration, which is a hot topic here over the past couple of years, and especially after what's been going on in several major cities. But before we do that, give us an idea why you wrote this book.
Wow. So I think the sort of kernel of what happened for this book happened actually when I was living in North Carolina going to graduate school. And there were more, you know, immigrants from Latin America coming to Durham, where I was living. And Durham, you know, is a historic Black city with a rich history. And a lot of the conversation was about how Blacks in the local area were being, you know, oppositional, if you will, toward immigrant communities. And what I was thinking was like, that's kind of a secondary emotion that's happening. I actually was like, this is not what I hear Black people saying. And I really wanted to write the story from the perspective of Black people and to reframe the narrative, not as, you know, Black people as kind of being, you know, the bullies on the playground who want to, you know, take their ball home and prevent other people from playing the game, but as people who are really concerned with the ways that whiteness and white supremacy get weaponized against them, and how to kind of protect themselves, if you will, or insulate themselves from those impulses.
Dr. Carter, let's look at it, or let me take the conversation back in reverse.
Okay.
Because me personally, just talking with people in my business, I deal with a lot of, in fact, 99% of the people that patronize my business are Black. Mm-hmm. So I hear a lot of conversations. In fact, it's an historic place for conversations among Black people. The ideal of citizenship, I think, really is the center of the argument, as far as I'm concerned, around this issue of Black people looking at this quote-unquote immigration problem in the U.S. Before we went to you, I read two of our ancestors' assessment of their status here in this country. William Whipper, after the first colored convention in Philadelphia in 1830, wrote the paper or edited the paper, The Colored American, and wrote that editorial in there in 1837 about Black people because he wanted them to be seen and eventually develop citizenship status. Du Bois wrote about the double consciousness and how Black people view themselves as American and as, he used the term Negro, but he was talking about African, and how it's a double consciousness in Black people. Then I played the clip from Dr. King when he said that if our people want to be free, that we're going to have to do this ourselves. That was basically what he was saying. So look at it from the perspectives of those three men over a span of almost 200 years, if you take it up until now. How is this citizenship as our people being viewed? Among Black people, we see ourselves as citizens of this country. But among the gatekeepers, I'll use the term, of white supremacy, you're a citizen at their behest. Give me your insight on this before I pass it over to Brother Richard, because I know he's chomping at the bit.
Well, I mean, I think both of those clips, and I was able to hear those, and I actually used Du Bois quite a bit in my own work, hit on something that I think Black people have been struggling with for a really long time, which is the constitutional citizenship that Black people have been granted has never really been lived up to. It's one thing for citizenship to be given or conferred statutorily. It's another thing when, as you note, there are many people who do not view Black people as quote unquote real Americans, who don't view Black sacrifice, not just in terms of wars, et cetera, but in terms of what we have contributed to this country, from the monuments we built to the intellectual contributions we've made, who don't acknowledge Black people. And then those very same people who want to violently excise Black people from the sort of fabric that is America, and would suggest that Black people have contributed nothing, not just to this country, but anywhere, right, in the world. And so there is a real Americanness, right, that Black people do profess. I think especially if you've ever gone abroad or been other places, you do realize there is something to who you are in this country that you see even more clearly when you're other places sometimes. But there's also a real instrumental part of this. Because when Black people often talk about patriotism, and this is some great work by a brother named Todd Shaw and others, they're not talking about waving a flag and wearing red, white, and blue. They're talking about making America live up to its promise, making America be better. Mm-hmm. In fact, I would say probably one of the things that Black people have contributed is that we are the true believers in America, in the sense that we are the people who make democracy real time after time. We are the people who strive for more inclusion, right? For more openness in this country, oftentimes at our own peril. We have done that time and again, because in some respects, Black people said, you said this on paper. This is the promise, right? This is the check that Martin Luther King refers to that you've written. And so we are here to cash it. And, you know, I think there is this difficulty with that, because America has shown time and time again that it does not love Black people back. And I think that's the real hard pill to swallow, is that Black people have given so much, we have done so much, and yet there is still this sense that Black people still need to prove something to this country.
I think you used the term conflicted nativism, but Richard, pick it up.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, first I want to say, as I went through, you know, as I was going through your book, and I'm going to reiterate the title so that everybody, I think it's important to get America While Black, African Americans, Immigration, and the Limits of Citizenship. One thing that struck me is the amount of the size of your bibliography. I mean, and then as I was going through it, I was saying, she, you know, like some people, you know, they use a reference for a point. You use like two and three, maybe sometimes four people to validate a statement that you're making. And is it because, and something that you put in there, is it because that you're proposing theory? And if it is, what is this theory that you're raising in relationship to the book?
Well, thank you for noticing something like marginalia. Usually people skip that part. Well, one thing of it is I went to Temple University. I was graduated with my degree in the Department of African American Studies. And I was taught by Sonya Peterson Lewis and Dr. Nathaniel Norman. And then in the history department, Dr. Betty Collier Thomas, Dr. Wilbur Jenkins. And one thing that they taught me was that you have backups to the backup, right? That one thing that we cannot afford is to kind of treat our history and our intellectual history flimsily, right? And very early, I was introduced to the Charles Blockton collection and all of that. So that's one of it. It's just my training, is that you cite and you cite and you cite. The other is, and this is, you know, something that you probably picked up on, I'm a political scientist by training. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the people that are reading this book or that are going to be commenting on this book and offering feedback on this book are not people who necessarily are sympathetic to the argument and the theory that I'm trying to put forward. And so for them, it often takes more to substantiate a claim that you or I would take for granted, because we talk to Black people. We live around Black people. We know Black people. We circle, you know, we involve ourselves in these spaces self-consciously in ways that some of my colleagues, quite frankly, don't. And so for me, it was one, it's how I was trained. It's the debt we owe to the intellectual progress, property prowess of our communities. And I mean communities broadly speaking. And then it's also just because I was maybe hyper aware that there might be some resistance to the claims that I'm making in this book.
And that claim in the sense that you're focusing on, and the one word mm-hmm. that I got as it relates to immigration, but it's centered to the clips that Elliot played, excuse me, to the African-American psyche itself, and you call it anxiety. Why anxiety, and why in relationship to immigration?
Yeah, that's a really great question. Thank you. So I use the term anxiety because, you know, it's too easy to call Black people angry. And there is some anger, some indignation in there. There is some hurt in there, a lot of hurt, a lot of pain, a lot of consternation. But I chose anxiety because it is that feeling of never quite knowing what to do, right? We have been told as a community of people since, you know, the 19th century at least, let's just say to the end of enslavement, that if we just worked hard, if we got education, if we got married, if we started businesses, if we made ourselves useful, if we were literate, then everything would be okay. Black people did everything we were supposed to do. And it has never been enough. The goalpost keeps moving. Quite frankly, we have been gaslit by America.
Ooh, excuse me.
And so that anxiety, I call it anxiety, because we never know what we are supposed to do. They tell us we have poor culture. They tell us that our hair isn't respectable, that the way that we speak isn't okay. And Black people do everything that we are supposed to do, that the nation says, if you do all of this, then you will be full Americans. We have given our lives for this country. In every major war this country has ever fought, Black people have been there. We have made ourselves industrious. We have made our own institutions of higher education. We have had businesses, owned land, gotten married, had family. We have done all of that. And still, you have America turning around and saying, oh, but there's this other thing that you have yet to do properly or to our satisfaction or to our liking. And I think it's the anxiety because time and again, I think many Black people have seen other people come to America and achieve the kind of acceptance, or at least the veneer of acceptance, that they have craved but can never get close to. And I think what Black people have started to put together, you know, have always known, is it's not them. It's America. And the anxiety they feel is because they know that as soon as there is another group that America can use as a cudgel against Black people, they will. And sometimes those very same groups will go along with that ruse, because it gives them a little bit of safety, a little bit of esteem. So that's why I call the anxiety, because you just never know which way America will go.
Yeah. Now, if I may, Elliot, you know, and since I got you, Dr. Carter, don't go nowhere.
Sure. Okay.
You know, because Elliot had mentioned it. One of the, I guess it's a conceptual framework that defines this sense of centeredness in relationship to the conflict that you raise, and you call it conflicted nativism. And I would like you to, you know, because it seems like you have you parsed out, as they say, how nativism is, how other people see nativism, how mm-hmm. Black folks see nativism, and then why you're saying that is, as it relates to Black folks, this nativism provides this sense of conflictedness. Could you do that for us, please?
Sure. So nativism is sort of like a chauvinistic kind of patriotism, if you will, right? So it's the belief in my country is the best country, and to be an American, you need to speak English, right? You need to have been born here. You need to be a Christian. These kinds of ideas, in a nutshell. The reason I say it's conflicted is because while Black people do claim Americanness because it means that we should be first in line, if there are any benefits, if there's any, you know, goodies to be had in this country, Black people should get it first because we were born here. But it's conflicted because that nativism is informed by the very same white supremacy that does not view Black people as full Americans. So it's a conflict because Black people have to walk a very fine line to not sort of take up the mantle of white supremacy while trying to be full Americans. And that's a very tricky line to walk, because part of what makes nativism appealing is this idea that if you're in the group, then you are a primary. But it's our Blackness that keeps us from being part of the group that is America, right? You know, when you hear people, I mean, I'll use, you know, Donald Trump, for example, saying things to Black people like, you know, these people want to keep the border open, you know, try me, what do you have to lose? And people being seduced by that. What they have to remember that on the other hand, he is saying something very similar to white people who don't want to see Black people or all of these immigrants, right, to use that term, get anywhere that they think that they shouldn't be socially, politically, or economically. So that is the line that Black people have had to walk, which is we can say that America needs to do something for Black America and not reiterate the same racist tropes and talking points. Because if we do, we're essentially saying we're in bed with the same people who don't want us to see us have full social political rights as other Americans. And so it's very difficult.
You know, one thing that, and I was going to go someplace else, but something that, you know, and again, in the exchange you and Elliot had around citizenship, and you mentioned, you know, as far as in the bibliography and which what has to be confirmed in this sense. I guess I'm something I've seen where you had, is white supremacy still the foundation of American identity? As your research and, you know, you're mm-hmm. going to do this book prove, could we still say in 2024 that white mm-hmm. supremacy is the foundation of American identity? Would that still be a true statement? I'll do it that way from your vantage
point. To my mind, yes. And I think what makes Black people important and why Black people are necessary is because we have a view of America and Americanness that does not rest on white supremacist foundations. But yes, I would absolutely say that that is still a very much a foundational belief.
Now I'm a stop. But another thing that got me before I turn it back over to you, Elliot, besides, and I'm harping on this bibliography because I. myself like marking, like, I got to get this. I got to get this. I got to get this. And I said, wait a minute, hold it. But the point that you had a survey in the back, mm-hmm. can you kind of, why mm-hmm. was it important to develop the questions to this survey mm-hmm. and what were they supposed to elicit?
Yeah, so I worked on a survey with a colleague of mine who was doing something similar. But the reason we wanted to do a survey is because when you talk to people with interviews, you get something very different. You get, you know, people talking and they give you a texture. You know, they give you, it's the beats in the conversation. You can hear it, right? Like you can hear the words in a quite literally, but you can also hear intent and other kinds of things. And so I knew my readers wouldn't be privy to that, right? Because I had those conversations with those individuals. They didn't. But what surveys allow you to do is make more generalizable claims than interview data will allow you to do. So I wanted to triangulate. I wanted the historical record. I wanted this qualitative data because, again, it's important to hear the textures of the conversation. And then I wanted this survey data to be able to make these more generalizable claims. Now, with the survey, what we wanted to achieve and why we asked the questions we asked is because those questions have been used by sociologists, political scientists, and others who've been studying nativism, nationalism, patriotism, et cetera. And I wanted to see, do they work on Black people in the same way and how? And in the book, I don't go into it in the same way, but in other papers I've done, I've used this same data and found that, you know, Black people do have a notion of Americanness, but it doesn't necessarily lend itself to the exclusionary or racist tropes that we often find that it does for white Americans. And that typically Black people with a strong sense of who they are as Black people are not exclusionary to others. So it's actually been, or that data was actually really important, not just in this book, but in subsequent work to show that. I also wanted, again, I'm speaking to an academic audience too that responds to certain kind of data points more than others. I also wanted it to be clear that this data, I was only going to look at Black people. I was not going to compare Black people to white people. And I actually got a ding for that. When I turned the book in, one of the reviewers said, well, she doesn't compare Black to white. And I say in the book, and I say it to that reviewer, and I say it to your listeners, white people are not a logical foil for Black people. Our experiences are different historically and otherwise. And so there's no reason to believe that comparing Black people to white people is going to be a useful analytical tool. I don't have an argument about what white people do. I have an argument about what white supremacy does to Black people and how it makes Black people think about this very particular domain, which is immigration. So it didn't make sense to me to compare Black people to white people, because white people are not, in my mind, they don't make the most sense, but it's what we do often as social scientists without real question about why are we comparing Black people to white people? Why do we do that? I don't have an argument.
I hate that. I really hate that.
Exactly. And it's hard sometimes, right? Because we grow up in an orthodoxy intellectually that tells us we should do this. And when you're saying, I've refused to do this because there's no intellectual reason why I should, it really does change the conversation. Because I didn't want this to be a book about white people. This is not a book about white people. This is a book self-consciously about Black people. And white supremacy is not necessarily about white people.
You know, Elliot, this, you know, you started with this whole thing about citizenship and we being Philadelphians, you know, this sometimes mm-hmm. I kind of believe that it you know, this whole American identity kind of thing starts here when we talk about the conventions and all. But just, you know, so I'm kind of interested in how this citizenship part plays in relationship to the nation state itself, this anxiety we have. And so, Elliot, I, you know, as I pass it back to you, I'm just, you know, interesting to see how Dr. Carter's premise, and I'm glad that you emphasize political science. So it isn't some, you know, just an opinion, but a scientific approach to an opinion, which I think is important, but how that relates to citizenship and immigration, especially in this time when immigration is such a hot button.
We're in conversation with author, associate professor in the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland, Dr. Nambi Michelle Carter, the book, America While Black, African Americans, Immigration, and the Limits of Citizenship. But Dr. Carter, you just mentioned to Richard, and Richard mentioned to you about the anxiety that Black people feel. And you said that the anxiety is basically around our people not knowing what to do, because we have done everything that, and I noticed you were used the word they have required of us, but it's still not enough. The goalpost keeps getting moved. It's never been, well, I don't want to say never. I don't think we have enough of critical discussions around what we should do as a collective about this issue, because all Black people feel this way to different degrees.
Yes.
Even ones of the quote unquote privileged class of Blacks, they all feel this anxiety to certain degrees, but it's not enough critical discussion on what we should do as a people around this. It's attacks constantly on the cultural memory of Black people. It's always given to us the way that we should look at people, and especially our heroes. A perfect example, Dr. King, a month ago, it was celebrations around Dr. King. And all of the celebrations, even by Black people, was around the 63 March on Washington, and we can all get along, but nothing around the last maybe 2-3 years before he was slain, and his views on geopolitical issues, dealing with Black people, and how he viewed the United States and what they was doing, what they were doing or participating in. No talk around that. It was just a narrative around they accepted Dr. King. So I think that kind of plays into what you're saying about the anxiety, but I just don't feel as though it's enough critical discussions on what our people should be doing or what we should do or alternatives, because it's clear that our people, a segment of our people wanted integration, but the majority of the gatekeepers of white supremacy, so to speak, wants assimilation. And it's a difference. Let me get your perspectives on that, Dr. Carter.
Well, I think that's a really big question, because I think we've been, as a community of people, talking about this, arguing about this, disagreeing about this, about what we should do for centuries. And that's a hard one. But I do think something you said was really important. One of the things we have to do is remember our own greatness and our own ingenuity as a community. Black people have achieved some amazing things for themselves, against all odds. And it's not always in deference or to placate whites. But I also understand, right, Black people are also very practical people. We live in this country. We recognize that whether we decide to divest or not participate or anything, there are still going to be decisions made by, about, and for us, even if we don't participate. Now, one of the things that Black people have always discussed, I think, and probably more so now than we've seen in a very long time, is trying to make separate communities. There are some folks in Georgia now trying to do that. And I think, you know, we can even look at, not in our very long past, Soul City in North Carolina, right, which was an attempt to create a more, not just diverse, because it was not an all-Black town, even though it was billed as such, but trying to create a more equitable place for people to live. It had health centers, recreation centers, homes, those kinds of things. But of course, we know when we try to do things within the United States, we're not sovereign. So the United States still gets to impinge upon us, right? The other possibility, and we've seen this, is Black people leaving America. That is a very real thing that Black people did, not just to Liberia and Sierra Leone, to Ghana, to different parts of the Caribbean, right? Haiti was a place for a very long time that Blacks went to because of its status as the independent Black Republican in the West, Black Republic in the West. But a lot more Black people went to Canada, right? Because it was close. We could keep an eye on what was going on in the United States, but far enough away to be, you know, free from enslavement, potentially. So leaving is an exit, right, is a strategy as well. And then there are those folks who, and you brought up Dr. King, and I'm glad you did, because I don't think Dr. King gets enough credit for his very strong critique of U.S. imperialism and capitalism and the ways that it only hurts Black people, but it hurts global communities of color that feel the brunt of American imperialism. And I think that's a really poignant point at this particular moment in our history with everything that's happening in Gaza. And so one of the things that I think King reminds us is that there may still be possibility in America, but we've never seen it. And so you can keep fighting and striving for that, but you can't be seduced. And I use that term a lot, but you can't be seduced by the crumbs that are left on the table or by the few that get through and that are able to have great success and that are able to become wealthy and all of those things. That as long as there are people who are still hungry, as long as there are people who still don't have adequate medical care, as long as there are still people who cannot access education, who cannot access the ballot, then our work here isn't done, and we shouldn't be self-congratulatory. I think it's a lot easier for people to have the sanitized version of King, because King was anti-war, anti-imperialist, anti-capitalist in many respects. And nobody wants to talk about that part of his legacy. He was a much closer, right, to a lot of people that folks like to call his detractors or his polar opposites than many would like us to believe. And I think a full reckoning with his legacy is really important. So as I try to wrap up this, because that was a very big question that has my mind going a million places just fighting, is that we can stay and fight, which is what we've opted to do time and time again. We can exit, right? Meaning we can leave this country and go elsewhere, or we can try to divest, which is form kind of self-sustaining communities. But we know that comes with, all of these are not options without negatives or perils attached to them.
You know,
and of course, I can only think this much. I'm sure there are other options, but these are the ones that I can think about most immediately.
You know, before we kind of shift gears to look at the immigration part of this, sure. Let me say something in reference to what you just said, Dr. Carter, because I think the three alternatives that you just brought up are things that need to be discussed nationally. And when I say nationally, I'm talking about in our churches, in our social organizations, in our book clubs, and by Black leadership. But Black leadership only tends to talk about voting and supporting different parties, whether they're Democrat or Republican. And that's where you get the disconnect. because if you look at the numbers, a lot of our people are not voting. They're not participating because they don't see the frustration, the anxiety is there. They're looking to leadership to give them options or to come up with solutions, and they're not. They're basically towing a party line, again, whether it's Democrat or Republican, and the people are dissatisfied. So this is really putting our people in a bind. And, you know, it's really going to come down to, let's see what it's going to come down to, because things are things are brewing in this country where we don't really, I'll put it this way, before we kind of transition over into talking about immigration. You had, before the Civil War broke out, you had a segment of our people that were quote unquote free. They didn't have bonds on. I don't necessarily use the term. They were free. And then you had a lot of our population that were enslaved. But then you had arguments and disagreements among whites as far as the distribution of the wealth that our people generated, which started that war, which started that conflict. You see some of the same type of things, although it's not centered around enslavement, but you see the same type of attitudes brewing now. And our people seem to be almost like in a tennis match. You know how you look, your head moves side and one to the other. You know, and I don't like to see our people like that, because we're looking for one thing, we're looking for another, and they're both fighting. You know, when they're doing this, we should be strategizing and planning on what we should be doing as a people if things don't work out, if things fall apart, if things don't go the way we think they should go for the benefit of our children. We should be strategizing. And I'm just throwing that out there, you know, and you can give opinions on it before we transition over or not.
Sure. I was just going to say, I think you're right. I mean, I think one of the things that as Americans we sometimes take for granted is that there will be another election. There will be another opportunity to get it right. There will be a republic to vote in the way that we do it before, right? Like, we take those things for granted. I think, unfortunately, you know, Black people are in the position of we're going to have to pat our heads and rub our tummies at the same time, because I think you're right. A lot of people are just so disaffected that they don't want to participate in the electoral system at all. And I get it. I definitely get it. But I always just urge people that these Supreme Court nominees that are likely to come through this next election cycle, right, whomever wins, the decisions that are going to get made are going to have these longer term repercussions for us, whether we show up to the ballot box or not. And lots of people would rather us not show up, because when Black folks show up, things tend to happen. Not necessarily for us, but electorally things happen. And I think the for us part is always the trickiest. But then we have to be thinking, like you said, while we are paying attention to what's happening in the election and participating, we can't feel self-satisfied that, oh yeah, we got it. And when we do have those sympathetic ears in those offices, we have to put the pressure on them. But we also, as you rightly noted, recognize that democracies do fail. Republics come and go. Our country is not exceptional. And should this country fall apart, what is going to be our strategy? Sure, there are going to be a lot of us who have to stay here for numerous and sundry reasons, right? Because you want to, because you don't really have a lot of options. And then there are going to be others that might have the ability to flee. But to go where? Because when we think about some of the sort of pressures that we feel, these are global phenomena. White supremacy isn't located in America. It's global.
Yes, you're right.
You know, we see it on the continent where we talk about bleaching creams and how people want to present themselves. We see it in Asia. We see it all over the world. And so if we know that, then where can we go and have a best life? It might not be the perfect life, And I think we have to start thinking about, like, in those Negro conventions that you talked about throughout the 19th century that we had, what does a version of a good life look like for us? We have to start thinking about that. And it's not just about access to capital. That's one thing, right? Some people might be excited about money. But for other people, it might just be to live with dignity, to not be able to predict the age I'm going to die because of my zip code, to be able to eat good food, to be able to walk down the street unmolested, to be able to make sure that my child has a quality education regardless of what our incomes are. So I think we have to start having those conversations again. And I think, as you noted, a lot of the social spaces that we use are great places to start. We don't necessarily have as many of those places now in a digital moment. But when you think about places like Harriet's Bookshop, or you think about, you know, these historic institutions like Mother Bethel, right, that are have been so important to our community's development in Philadelphia, but also nationally and internationally, we have to start thinking about using those spaces beyond sort of their intention. Barbershops, Bible, right? Barbershops and Bibles have been, you know, bedrocks of our community, to borrow the phrase from Melissa Harris Perry, right? So how can we make those places vibrant, more connected now? Because you can't tell me we have less opportunity to talk as a community, both nationally and globally, than we did 200 years ago.
No, we don't have less, especially when you go to social media.
Exactly.
Big Rose is talking. I stop. I apologize.
Right. No apologies.
We're going to take a brief break. When we come back, we're going to continue the conversation. And you can get involved, too, by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. Our guest this evening in conversation, author, associate professor at the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland, Dr. Niambi Michelle Carter. The book, America While Black, African Americans, Immigration, and the Limits of Citizenship. We'll be right back.
Awakening with host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9836.
Escape the digital plantation. Abibitumi.com, Abibitumi.tv, Abibitumi.tv.com, Abibitumi.store are here for you. You are ready to be free of non-African social media. Don't run from danger, run to safety. Abibitumi.com is here for you. You are ready to be free of digital plantations to control your own products. Abibitumi.store is here for you. ABIBITUMI. Black Power, ABIBITUMI. The only word you need to know to join your global KometU Black family, to join your interconnected KometU Black communities. Escape the digital plantation now. Abibitumi.com, Abibitumi.tv, Abibitumi.tv.com, Abibitumi.store. We are here for you. Escape the digital plantation.
A new era, a new phase of the struggle, where we have moved from a struggle for decency, which characterized our struggle for 10 or 12 years, to a struggle for genuine equality. And this is where we're getting the resistance, because there was never any intention to go this far. People were reacting to Bull Connor and to Jim Clark rather than acting in good faith for the realization of genuine equality.
Do you think white people in this country, and I'm talking about non-segregationist people devoid or thinking they're devoid of racism, do you have any idea of what they want the Negro to be in America?
I think the vast majority of white Americans will go but so far. It's a kind of installment plan for equality. And they are always looking for an excuse to go but so far.
And know that this problem needs to be solved, and we can't keep relegating it to generation after generation because a few of us got a little money, a few of us got positions, a few of us have wealth, while the masses of our people are going steadily down. No one man can rise above the condition of his people. See, brother said responsibility. Is it that we should let them take responsibility to do for us, or should we pool the knowledge that's at the table, the power that's in our community, the wealth that's in our community to change the harsh reality of Black life in America? We have to do the job of fulfilling the Black agenda.
Whites are expert game players in their contests to maintain absolute power. One of their time-honored gimmicks is to point to individual Blacks who've achieved recognition. But look at Ralph Bunche. Think about Lena Horne or Mary Anderson. Look at Jackie Robinson. They made it as one of those who has made it. I would like to be thought of as an inspiration to our young, but I don't want them lied to. Name them for me. Examples of Blacks who made it. For virtually everyone you name, I can give you a sordid piece of factual information on how they have been mistreated, humiliated. Not being able to fight back is a form of severe punishment.
I come here tonight and plead with you. Believe in yourself and believe that you're somebody. As I said to the group last night, nobody else can do this for us. No document can do this for us. No Lincolnian Emancipation Proclamation can do this for us. No Kennisonian or Johnsonian Civil Rights Bill can do this for us. If the Negro is to be free, he must move down into the inner resources of his own soul and sign with the pen and ink of self-assertive manhood his own Emancipation Proclamation. Don't let anybody take your manhood.
Time for an Awakening is a proud part of the Black Talk Radio Network, the number one independent Black digital and podcasting platform.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. It's 8:08 here in this Sunday edition of Time for an Awakening. Our guest this evening in conversation, author, Associate Professor in the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland, Dr. Naomi Michelle Carter. The book, America While Black, African Americans, Immigration, and the Limits of Citizenship. Dr. Carter, I didn't lose you, did I, Dr. Carter?
No, I'm here.
Okay. Before I want to kind of set up our conversation to kind of shift gears over to immigration, because it's directly related to what we were talking about in the first hour of white supremacy. Let me play, and I played this before for the Time for Waking audience, but let me play this clip by,
okay,
you might be aware of it, and you may not, by freshman, I'm not sure he's a congressman, Joshua Jackson, Jesse Jackson's son. He had a meeting with the residents in Chicago because, like Chicago and New York and a few other cities, migrants are coming in and they're putting them smack dab in a lot of black communities and using libraries, police stations, recreation centers, and the people are upset. Listen to what he said in relation to the migrant issue, because I've never heard any of the other congressmen, and I'm talking about some of your popular ones, come back and tell their communities what he tells them here. Let me play this, because I think it kind of is important to our conversation this evening.
Okay.
I'll just go to this very quickly. The challenges that we have. Hold on. Easy. So here we go. What's happening in Chicago right now, the migrant crisis? We're looking at warehouses being used, police stations, schools, libraries, all of these different places. I want to give you a little bit of a background on how do we get to this point and where the federal government is and what's happening in Chicago. So this will be a deep dive. I'm not a flyby, and I can sit here and talk with you all night long. So this is what you got me here for, so I'm available. I'm not running. Okay. Where are the migrants coming from in this wave? The migrants in large part are coming from Venezuela. What's happened in Venezuela? The United States, after President Hugo Chavez came to power almost 15 years ago, he has since has died. He was a socialist and was doing a lot of economic reforms. There was a backlash against his government by the United States. So we started doing an embargo, blocking his oil sales. Then from there, we started the sanctions under the Trump administration. So what's happened in the last 15 years in Venezuela is they've had the equivalent of three Great Depressions. So this is one of the wealthiest countries on earth if they could sell their oil. But they've had the equivalent of three Great Depressions. So now over 7 million people have had to leave their country. Many of the people that you're seeing in these shelters and police stations over had a house, had an apartment, had a place to stay.
Elliot, I think it got lost.
Yeah, I can't hear it anymore.
Yeah. Elliot? Oh, he must have cut out. And until he does, until he recognizes, let me do this. Dr. Carter, as you are dealing with, well, I picked up as we're dealing with immigration, you frame it that the way black folks deal with immigration is different, but I'm going to use this term, and maybe it's out of context for what you meant, that immigration, as a threat, do black folks see immigration as a threat? From the work that you've done? And if it is, what type of threat is it? And that's if it is, from the work mm-hmm. you've done. Is it a threat? And if it is, how have we as a people really seen immigration?
Well, it's a both and. So yes, it's a threat, Mostly people see it as an economic threat, not a cultural threat. So people aren't worried about whether we'll be speaking English or any of those kinds of things. People are concerned about whether they'll be able to be employed, whether, you know, people prefer Latino workers over them or some other kind of person over native-born Black Americans. But when I talked to people, though, they didn't necessarily feel like their particular jobs were endangered, which I thought was really interesting. So it's sort of like Black people are thinking, the Black people I spoke to, let me say, are thinking about these economic threats for other Black people, but not necessarily for where they find themselves. So it's interesting that even in this particular issue, Black people are thinking about, well, what does this mean for the larger Black community? Not just me. Like, I know my job isn't endangered, but I worry that other people will find themselves endangered. There was also a streak of this, and I'm sure you've heard it, of people being concerned that immigrants are allowed to get tax breaks and other kinds of support financially from the federal government. And that's a longstanding kind of trope. We've heard it a lot. I think it's misunderstood, but it exists. And the fact that it exists and that people believe it is sort of more important than whether it's true or not. Because I think people conflate a few things together. So when refugees come to the United States, there is some limited, very limited assistance that they can get when they're here. But it ends very shortly after they get to the United States, and it does not include like tax-free loans and things like that to start businesses. But it is the case that when we see immigrants start businesses, some of that is about how communities circulate money and not necessarily about the government doing something, right? Sure, there may be issues around credit worthiness and how we think about that, but there's also, you know, practices where people may live in multifamily homes and save money together and support the business of one member of their community or their family, and then the next member of that family gets into that business, right? They put that money to that person. So it's sort of like SUSUs and the way we use them in our communities traditionally, where we save money together and we give money cooperatively. We see this in other communities on a richer, larger scale. But nonetheless, we know that Black people have had very great difficulties accessing capital to start businesses. When we look at the businesses that shuttered during COVID, many of them being Black-owned businesses. Yet we know that Black people as entrepreneurs, that spirit is still there. I mean, Black people are out here building things, creating things, making businesses, but are just not generally able to access the capital to push their businesses forward. So yeah. The threat is usually economic, and it's usually about concerns for other people, not just themselves.
And the thing that got me as you were speaking it and I was listening is how, you know, our different views about, and I'm saying ours as Black people views is about, you know, being used within the political agenda of immigrations. Do you have, it's not necessarily, I don't think it's developed particularly in your book, but is it, I'll do it that way, is it, or how do you see from your vantage point, the party system is playing on Black folks' sentiment as it relates to immigration, as it relates to our uneasiness in being in a white supremacist society. How does the politics play on that? And we see this back.
Yeah. I mean, I think it could go a few ways. Well, I mean, I think on the most sort of basic level, we certainly see on some kind of conservative places, this pulling on sort of this notion of Black progress, right? Like, these immigrants are the reason why your group is not doing as well. And if they weren't here, you would do better, right? So you see that kind of strain happening. You also see, you know, with these, I mean, you, Elliot started with the conversation around Chicago and sort of what was happening with Chicago. But, you know, the movement of these migrants from Texas, from Florida, which are sort of traditional immigrant gateways, and then dropping them off in Massachusetts, in New York, in Chicago, in D.C., right? Places with large Black populations, but also have real resource kinds of crunches in those cities, pushes those communities against each other, because a lot of what we're talking about, whether we're talking about social welfare programs or educational access, these are kind of zero-sum resources. And so when you present another group of people, it doesn't matter where these people are from, quite frankly. Black people are going to get their backs up, because we are already fighting for very real basic needs in these cities and these localities. And now there are these other people that are coming here who are not citizens, who need and require things. And as human beings, we understand that, right? Black people are not inhumane. But it is a real concern about what does this mean for us? Because if you already tell me we don't have city services for rec centers, or we don't have enough teachers in our schools, or we don't have enough hospitals, but now we're supposed to provide aid for all of these different people who are not even citizens. What does this mean? And so I think that's what you're seeing in these places, this real frustration, because it's like when there's a war or something else, America will shake the couch cushions and find some extra trillions of dollars to spend. But when it's about real flesh and blood Americans, right, who live here, there's never enough. There's never enough money for food assistance. There's never enough money for clean air or clean water, i.e. Flint and other cities that are Newark and other places, right? D.C. even, Baltimore. There's never money for that. There's never money for any of those things that Black people so desperately want and need. But when there is something else, when it seems like there's another group in trouble or another country that we might be geopolitically concerned with, we can always find the money. And I think that's the kind of frustration that we see spilling over in New York and Chicago and other places in D.C.
I see you're back, Elliot.
Yeah, I don't know what happened there.
You start talking that geopolitic thing and trying to, you know, the United States and Venezuela, and then all is like, wait a minute, we got to stop this.
I don't know how much you heard of that, Dr. Carter. I guess it was about maybe one quarter of the way through when it looked like things shut down. I'll play that again because I wanted to get your perspective on what he said in relation to white supremacy. But let me go to and see if a couple of callers want to have some comments or questions. Caller, are you there?
Yes. Good evening, Richard Elliott, and to your guests, Mrs. Carter. I just have a quick question. At this date and time, really, what role do Black people have in this country right now?
That's a big question. So I'll do my best, and thank you for calling in. Honestly, I think, you know, and maybe this is to our detriment, right? Our sadness as a country, our patheticness, our pathetic nature as a country. Is that the role of Black people is the role that it has been for a very long time. And I don't mean just as builders, because when you think about American culture, you think about Black people, right? I mean, the Super Bowl is on right now. And when you think about whose bodies are running on that field and who's doing that at the halftime show, right? People call it the Usher Bowl, right? Everything that we have, in my opinion, much of what we have to export to the world, to sell to the world, comes from Black people. But beyond just being commodities, as voters, as representatives, as other things, Black people have been the conscience of this nation. I mean, because what happens to Black people actually does matter for other people. They may not see it. They may not think about it as such, but it does. When you have, you know, Jonathan Metzl, who wrote that book, Dying of Whiteness, poor white trajectories look a lot like Black folks' trajectories. They don't think so. But if they've been paying attention and had used their power to make different choices politically, they might find themselves with some different outcomes, right? But it's what Lyndon Johnson said. You convince a white person that he is better than a Negro, you can pick his pocket all day. And that's still true. And it is not fair that in many respects, Black people remain the sort of workhorses of the United States, and not in the sense of, you know, tilling the fields, but in the sense of we're the ones who are keeping this country afloat politically in many respects. Because when we show up at the polls, that's important. When we put our, I guess, weight behind political candidates, that's important. So I think Black people have had to force the United States to be better than what it is. And it's still failing to do so. But, you know, that's my best answer. We make this country what it is, quite frankly.
And you know, sorry to say this, but as someone like yourself who has certain privileges that others don't have because of your education, that's kind of sad, because if you put it into its most honest perspective, the sole purpose that Black people honestly have in this country in regards to white people is sex and labor, because we're now in a position and a point to where, as other ethnic groups are coming into this country and replacing us on a level that I don't even think that Black people, who are supposed to be the most intelligent, so-called superior, even understand. And the reason why I say this is, if you look at what's going on with what Edward Blum is doing, I think a lot of people in a certain position don't understand the ramifications that will happen depending on how far that goes. And then when you talk about if the psychopath narcissist gets back in office, you then have to deal with Project 2025. And I honestly don't think that our so-called leaders and our so-called intellectuals understand the situation that they're in, because like you just said, we think that if we participate and go about the business of trying to save this democracy, then we sustain ourselves in a position of, as one would say, being appreciated and loved by our perpetual enemy. It's kind of tragic that we really, in all honesty, don't understand that. And what's sad is that these people who are coming into this country in the next 10 to 20 years are going to have us in a position like the Native Americans.
Thank you for your contribution, brother.
Thank you.
Let's go to, well, before we go to the next call, any, did you want to say anything in reference to, his closing comments, Dr. Carr?
You know, it's a lot to take in because those are very real feelings and those are very real sensibilities. And, you know, I understand that anxiety, right, about being replaced and all of that. And I'm not sure that we'll be replaced, but, you know, there are some things about our community that are just very American, right? We are having fewer children, right? We are delaying childbearing till we're getting older. All of those things are just very American things. They're not necessarily Black or white things. But I think when you're talking about a group that is not a large group and is not really getting bigger, and we look at, you know, the birth rates and the youth of other communities, it is a real eye-opener, if you will. And we have to your point earlier, I can't remember if you or Elliot, whether you or Robert made that point about we having to strategize. We are in the position, even though we are small as a community, right? Black people are around 14% of the American population, but we are the most well-represented in national, local, and state politics. But that will change. So what can we learn from this moment about how to prepare and how to move forward? You know, and how to think about what it looks like for the next phase of what our lives are going to look like, what our realities are going to be in America.
Let's go to
Go ahead, Richard. You know, go to the next caller, because there's two sections in your book that I feel kind of address that, and it goes to what you spoke to earlier. The section about Black history and immigrants, and the section about collective memory and public and Black public opinion. Because it seems to me the answers of this moment is no different than the moments we've been dealing with this immigration challenge that you kind of also outline. So it's a question of, you know, even with strategy, it's like if we're centered in our own history, that and we have the solution. You know, if we're centered in our own collective memory, we have the solution. It's when we're disconnected from those two that we think that we're at a different point uniquely in this society that I don't believe we're at. I just had to interject that as a part that you addressed that in my mind, even in this text and in your research, and that it's important for us to understand that, as you said, why you didn't want to do a comparison. We have to be centered in our own history and believe it. We have to be centered in our own memory and believe it. And then we can deal with even the immigration challenge that's in front of us, it seems to me.
Well said.
You know, before we did, let's go to New York City. New York City.
Greetings, brothers. This is Brother Maurice. Greetings to the professor. I hope all is going well today for everybody.
How are you, sir?
Thank you.
I was sitting here listening, and I love the conversation. What I was thinking, Professor, was that the narrative, the history has a tendency to repeat itself, and I just think that this is like a regeneration of the know-nothing people, where we're just substituting, you know, the Irish Catholics, and we're putting particular immigrants in that particular piece, but most people don't know that's the 1850s we're talking about, and Trump is the reimagining of that. Matter of fact, I said Trump was the second coming of Woodrow Wilson in terms of his political philosophy and disrespect toward Black people. I was reading an article dealing with Black Americans on the issue of Pew Research talked about this idea of success in America, and the thing that I thought was so interesting about it when you keep looking at the conversation where you have in the 60s young people talking about, I have no flag, I have no country, or you have someone like Baldwin saying that if this country doesn't get it right, the first time, you know, was water, this time would be fire. Those type of conversations don't seem to be motivating people to make any type of political or economic change in this particular nation. So when I'm listening to a lot of people talking about these things, especially among the younger people, Professor. My concern is that, again, they believe that their allegiance is the almighty dollar. And when you look at the survey by Pew Research Center, it talks about all of these economic things that that attribute to success and happiness. And there's no cultural basis in any of that. All of this is about money, and it's not about who we are as a people. And so, again, it goes back to that issue of not feeling welcome. I used to say that, you know, they talk about America is this whole melting pot. I said, well, I guess we're the bitter beef. We're the stuff that upsets the stomach. So, you know, I don't understand, you know, but like, for example, I have my own TV show and I talk a lot about what's going on in Chicago and New York. It's impacting my neighborhood. My neighborhood is, they're dumping a lot of people in this neighborhood. Not just the immigrants, but they dump a lot of the homeless shelters and all these other places, and it's impacting this community. I wrote a paper for my thesis on this whole idea of how this place went from neighborhood to ghetto, and how the forces shaped it. And again, we have people here that have been fighting against this. I remember my mother and my father fought to keep this neighborhood a certain way. So it seems like the narrative is we're losing ground. We're continually losing ground. And I'm going to ask this question, and I'm going to shut up. I was struggling because I was trying to find some area where there were Black political scientists or polls that were by Black people that we could go to. Instead of going to Pew Research or, you know, some of these other places and stuff, I wanted to go somewhere because sometimes when me and Brother Elliot and Brother Richard will have conversations, we'll talk about some of these polls, and we can, and you know, polls can be skewed based on the type of questions they ask to get a certain result.
Absolutely.
So let me just be quiet and listen to your thoughts on this whole idea, that this whole nativism idea is nothing unique. It's a part of this American culture, and all we have to do is just move, you know, like a puzzle, pull pieces out and just drop other pieces in. Because that's been going on in this country from, because they were afraid of the Catholics taking over. Now this is a new narrative and stuff. So I'll be quiet and listen.
Well, there's a lot in here. And I think, you know, when you were talking about the surveys, I will say one place to look is the CNPS. It's the Collaborative Multiracial Post-Election Survey. It's out of UCLA. I don't know what data may be available, but they've been doing this post-election survey since around 2017. And what makes this survey unique is that they have it's mostly communities of color, and they do it in multiple languages, which is also something that matters when we're doing surveys. So Tagalog, I think Mandarin, Spanish, English. So that's one survey to look at. And then if you go to the ICPSR website at University of Michigan, it's an interconsortium for something research. I'm sorry, my brain is on E right now. That's another place to look for some of these polls, because there is great work being done. The African American Roundtable, Spencer Overton, and those folks are doing some great work on Black public opinion. So that's one part of it. To your point about people being disaffected, I get it. I understand it. America's system is designed to frustrate you, to make you tired, to make you not pay attention, because while there is variance in terms of who's running and that kind of stuff, in terms of how parties function and that kind of stuff, that doesn't vary very much. And I think, again, this goes back to something I said earlier, being around young people, working with young people, I know they care about a lot of things. I know they're passionate about a lot of things. How they think about achieving those things is different. And they don't necessarily see the political system as viable. But as I have to remind them, you know, Clarence Thomas has been on the Supreme Court since I was 13 or 14 years old. These people that are on the Supreme Court now are likely to be there until they're old and gray. And so the decisions that we make today will have longer term consequences. And just because you participate in the electoral system doesn't mean you believe in it, doesn't mean that you think it's the most legitimate or the only way that we can do things. Of course we can do things other ways. We could have multiple party systems. We could do proportional voting. We could do all kinds of things that would be different, maybe even more equitable and fair, right? But just because you don't believe in it doesn't mean that it doesn't believe in you. And refusing to act is a political choice. I will never denigrate that choice. But it doesn't mean that the choices made for you won't matter for your life. And it's not just about taxes, because as you know, a lot of people talk about politics in terms of money. But capitalism hasn't saved Black people yet. Capitalism is designed, and by design, everybody can't be at the top of the food chain. There are going to be winners, right? Meaning the richest. And there are going to be people who do okay, right? The kind of middle class that is waning, by the way, right? The middle class is shrinking. And then there are going to be those who are the sort of losers in the system, the workers, right? All of us work in different capacities, but we are not all held hostage by work in the same way. And I think your caller earlier noted that, right? I recognize that I have a certain kind of privilege. I know that I'm portable in some ways that a person like my grandfather never could have been. My grandfather was a sharecropper. So there was no way for him to escape, quote unquote, right? In the same ways that I can. And part of that sacrifice is to make sure that I had more options than he had, than his children had. But I also understand that because of my Blackness, there are going to be limits to that. How many of us are middle class or on the verge of middle class, but we have no generational wealth or very little? Right. You know, so even capital for us doesn't work the same way. You know, when we look at the billionaires and the millionaires in our community, the LeBron Jameses and those people are one generation wealthy. They're living next to people who are probably dentists. Right. And it's like, how does that happen? Right. And that's the way capitalism is designed. A few of us get through. Some of us muddle through and the rest of us trudge through. And, you know, when people talk about the virtues of capitalism as if that's the end all be all, it's not, because we know capitalism supports a lot of the same systems that lend themselves to oppression and exclusion.
Yes.
So we got to work, right? Because we got to eat, we got bills to pay, we got things we have to do. But we can also acknowledge the very perverted relationship that capitalism makes us have with it. And
yeah, I just want to say this real quick in response to what Brother Jay said. Again, I keep telling people, you know, and he's, you know, I've been talking about Edward Blum for the longest time, with the dismantling of all types of things and stuff. He's been busy since, Fisher versus Texas, and even before then, you know, with Bakke and all of that. Yeah, so, but the thing is this, right? But Jay, I think it was Brother Jay that was speaking before, is missing, is that you have this idea that they need Black people. They don't need any people. In Salem, Oregon, they've already built factories for robots. Okay, one of the major CEOs was talking about from one of these shipping places was talking about how they're going to lay off like 12,000 people and stuff, because they, and you see it's already going on in all these different sectors as artificial intelligence and technology is taking place. Where do you ask, where do Black people fit in? Where does any person fit in this particular society? So now they're going to see the virtues of a capitalism, right? Because it's about always making that profit. And I tell people, you can feel comfortable all you want as many when they put all these people out of work, because you think it's a good thing because your 401k is increasing, right? You know,
right.
But the bottom line is this: they still need to have people to be consumers in this particular economy, because it doesn't make any sense to make a product if you can't sell it to somebody. And this is where this universal basic income conversation is going on. And again, I have to say this, it's really annoying me, because this is the part where they're trying to tie this universal basic income into reparations and stuff. And again, as you talked about the, you know, how they look at us as quote unquote you know, Americans or undeserving Americans. We can see by the laws that they push forward just in California, none of that had any type of monetary attachment to it. So I'm going to say that, and I'm going to actually hang up and listen.
Thank you for your contributions.
Yeah, I was going to say that was great. I mean, I think you're right. We are heading into a new world. And what does that look like? Because I think we're seeing, you know, how thin we can stretch this underclass, right? Before there's some real repercussions to that. I mean, I'm not trying to sound doom and gloom, but I mean, just look around the world. But I also think his point about Ed Blum, I think, was really important. I forgot that part, and I wanted to address it while he was still on, because I think it's an important point. One of the things that Ed Blum has been really successful at doing is changing the narrative and changing the conversation and making us all participate in that conversation. No matter how meritless, there is a need to respond to the sort of definitional shift that Ed Blum has ushered in, whether we're talking about affirmative action or whether we're talking about climate change or whether we're talking about any of these other issues. What Ed Blum has been very excellent at doing is messaging and making other people who have an investment in that very same policy believe that they have more in common with him than they do with Black folks, right? And what I mean by that is, like, when we talk about, when your caller was talking about the affirmative action decision and kind of all of that stuff that's been happening, Black people were used as the sort of poster child for affirmative action gone wrong, right? And it was easy to get people to buy into it because many people already believe that Black people are not smart, not capable, and undeserving. And then he used Asian people to take out race in college admissions. But those very same people don't recognize that ending affirmative action was going to actually hurt them too. Because if people believe that some imaginary Black or Latino child was taking a seat from an Asian kid who was much more deserving, then they haven't been paying attention. Getting rid of affirmative action was about being able to create more space for white people.
Mm-hmm.
Not take seats for under, but it's easy, again, to use Black people to weaponize notions about Black incompetence because so many people already believe it. And it's easy to get other people who are strivers, right? These Asian people who were participating in this, they probably don't hate Black people. I'm sure they don't. They're strivers. They want their kids to do well. And getting admission to these particular institutions is what it means to do well. So they are being told the same thing. If your kids can just go to the right schools and do the right things, they can make the right money and they'll be okay. But this was never about them, because we are supposed to believe that Ed Blum really cares about Asian kids. He doesn't. They really care about white kids. And if it meant using some narrative about Black incompetence and some other group that is striving for acceptance and inclusion to get to a place where they could protect whiteness, then that's what they were going to do. And that's what happened. And so I appreciate your caller for connecting those dots. But I do want to caution people, right, from saying, yeah, you know, things that might be really disparaging about Asian people, because most Asian people actually support affirmative action. And most Black people, even recognizing what immigration can mean, are the most supportive of more liberal immigration policies than anybody else. So we recognize the need for self-determination. We understand why people want to leave. And we also are very, very, very cautious about finding ourselves in bed with white supremacists. We have been. I fear that that moment is changing a bit. But traditionally, Black people have been very cautious about getting in bed with white supremacists.
Let's go to Philadelphia. Philadelphia? Caller?
Yeah. Okay. I just wanted to say that I appreciate your guest, Dr. Carter, for her contributions and hard work for our people, and definitely want to get that book. And just wanted to say real quickly, I keep hearing about Trump all the time. You know, he said, make America great again. America always been great. It's always been greatly against black people, greatly evil and wicked. You know, and since George Washington up to Biden, it's always been against black people. It don't matter what personality you put in there, it ain't going to benefit us. So we need to unite and do for ourselves. But a lot of us haven't escaped the curse of Willie Lynch, that division, that self-hatred. And until we do that, we're going to keep on getting bombarded every year. You know, vote, 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 and ain't going to get nowhere. We was better off when we was segregated. At least we united and had more businesses. You know, it was not fair to us, but at least we would had more businesses and stuff. Now we ain't got nothing. We are more a dependent people instead of being, dependent instead of being independent. We depend on white folks for everything. We should be like the Amish people. But anyway, I'll pass the mic and shut up.
Thanks for your contribution. No,
thank you. Yes, sir, thank you.
Let's go to. Go ahead. Go. I'm sorry.
No, I hear what the brother was saying, because I understand that frustration. Because again, many people understood, even with segregation on the wane, they didn't necessarily mean they wanted to give up their communities and their institutions. They wanted fairness. They wanted equality, but that didn't mean we wanted to give up the communities we live in and that we nurtured and that we love and our businesses and all of those things. And so I feel very much the callers, it's beyond concern, but disappointment and all of that with what black people had to give up and not really seeing a return for doing it.
Let's go to Philadelphia again. Call it.
Brother Elliot.
Yes, sir.
How you doing, Brother Elliot?
Great.
That's good. How you, Brother Richard and Dr. Carter? How you doing, my dear sister?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
You're welcome. All praise be to Allah. Dr. Carter, I just want to say a few comments. When you was talking earlier to Brother Elliot and Brother Richard, you said about how the psychosis of white supremacy and how some black people, they think because they start looking at themselves as the reason for their failure, as opposed to looking at white people as the cause. And that reminds me, your comments remind me of a black scholar on a local radio station said a few years ago. He said black people need to stop using that term. And I have to catch myself sometimes, Dr. Carter. He said we need to stop saying things like, well, they are against us because we're black. He said, no, they're against you because they're white. You know, put the onus on them, not you, not on your blackness. Because when you say it's because we are black, then that makes it like something wrong with us. He said, no, they act in demonic and devilish the way they are because they are white, not because you're black. And that resonated with me, Dr. Carter, when this scholar said that on the local radio station. And that's why I try a lot of times to keep from saying that myself, because sometimes we lose track of things and I get caught up in that, but I try to keep that on my thought process. No, when these white folks do their crazy stuff, they're racist, not because I'm a black man, it's because they're white. You know, that simple. And, you know, earlier, Dr. Carter, you made a comment, too, about how we always have to try to walk that so-called fine line to try to, you know, fit in or try to do the right things. And let me share a couple of stories with you real quick. And that is so true because, you know, as a 62-year-old black man, I try to tell the young brothers to pull their pants up because it doesn't look nice to walk around with your underwear showing. I mean, let's just be honest about it. They just don't look nice. But that being said, you know, like one of the brothers who hosts a local radio show here in Philadelphia on a black radio station, who happens to be a college professor like yourself, he says that, you know, he said, that's definitely, we should do that, Brother Joe. He said, but at the same time, he said, we should also let our brothers know that you can be dressed with a suit and tie on and that still don't stop the criminality of white people towards black people. Because he shared a story, Dr. Carter, about how he this briefcase, a suit and tie on, recently, an incident with this white woman was clutching her pocketbook in broad daylight. I hear this man got a nice suit on, tie on, briefcase, you know, nice dress, nice shoes, everything. Looked like a lawyer, doctor, whatever like that. And this white woman still was acting like he was going to rob her, you know what I mean? And so when the brother shared his story, Dr. Carter, I shared a story with him about Earl Graves Jr., you know, from Black Enterprise magazine, the son, yes, who they referred to as Butch. He shared the story about years ago. He was at a convention in Miami at this five-star hotel. He's on the elevator, Dr. Carter, and his white woman. Now, here this man got all the money. He had money to buy that hotel. You know what I mean? His family's very wealthy. And a white woman, she studied clutching her pocketbooks, looking over her shoulder. He was like, well, miss, you know, you acting like that. I could buy your pocketbook. I could buy a whole Gucci collection of Gucci pocketbooks and buy this hotel. But it just shows the paranoia and the fear and the sickness of these white people. Because this was about like this brother was dressed like a thug or whatever like that. He was dressed like a nice, you know, man, you know, Italian loafer, suit, tie on, expensive briefcase, Rolex watch, dressed to the nines. But yet they still didn't stop this white lady from looking at him as a potential criminal, you know. And I've had that experience myself as a 60-year-old black man downtown, which I go every day to help my friend out at the newsstand. White women constantly, you know, cucks their pooks like I'm a robber. I had to tell one white woman recently, I said, miss, if I wanted to rob you, miss, I could do it. Ain't nothing in the damn thing you could do if I wanted to rob you. I said, you can just cool out, miss. I'm not no criminal. I said, it's just, and she kind of looked at me and she like apologized slightly. Well, I'm so sorry. I said, no, well, let's let it go. And it's moved on. But it just shows you, Dr. Carter, how what black people face in this country, whether you dress like a so-called thug or whether you dress with a suit and tie on, that fear and that criminality of black men, it definitely continues to happen in society. That's why, you know, we have to think highly about ourselves. Like you say, Dr. Carter, think highly about ourselves and don't let that, you know, destroy our self-esteem. You know what I mean? That's why I appreciate what you're saying tonight on the show, Dr. Carter. Can you give our people words of wisdom and how to, you know, because with black people, let's be honest, we have to learn how to, you know, go through that maze with white supremacy and get through it with our dignity intact and our pride intact and our humanity intact. We cannot let this sickness destroy our humanity. And I think that's what a lot of times we have a struggle, you know, dealing with, Dr. Carter. So I appreciate you and what you bring to the table tonight.
Well, thank you. And I appreciate you for that note about reminding ourselves how to speak, because I hadn't even thought about that, but I will definitely be making that change. Thanks to you.
You're welcome, Dr. Carter, and Brother Elliot and Richard. Thanks for the good show tonight, and I'll put me on mute, and I'll listen to the rest of the show.
Thank you for your contribution.
You're welcome.
Dr. Carter, before we let you go, a couple of things I want to mention to you, and it came around the time we got cut off. I was observing one of the talks that you had online with some students, and you mentioned about your uncle who came back from Korea, I think you said, and started his own business, or maybe it might have been World War II, and started his own business down there where your folks are from in North Carolina, the masonry. They were brick masons.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And you talked about his struggles when you went to a family reunion, and, you know, I guess he's a retired gentleman now, talked about his struggles trying to compete when he's paying laborers $20 to $25 an hour, which is a livable wage. And other people are working for $8 an hour, and he just can't compete. But, you know, that kind of lends to the conversation that we had last week with our guests. Our people adopting European cultural values, especially when you're talking about Western capitalism, where somebody has to be exploited in order to be successful. When we adopt those values, it's counterproductive to us as a people. I mean, I really believe, and you can basically attest to this yourself, that when your uncle was doing that, he had some sense of who he was as a black man, the other folks that he was dealing with. And as far as his care for them as human beings and as potential family people or if they did have a family, to have a livable wage, not to be able to, because being the case, you will be able to make money to sustain your family and to do other things. You don't have to oppress somebody. and he was still able to give people a livable wage according to what you said, but now he just couldn't compete anymore. I just thought that was interesting when you brought that up and talked about the values of your uncle as opposed to him not being able to compete now in a capitalist doggy dog type of environment.
But you know, I thank you for bringing that up because my uncle is one of my favorite people, and he was in Vietnam, and I think part of what informed how he approached his position as a business owner, as a skilled laborer, because being a brick mason is a skill, was watching my grandfather be a sharecropper and be thankful every year that he didn't have a bad harvest. That's a terrible way to live. The uncertainty, the fear, the anxiety. And, you know, it made me think about what Martin Luther King said about not letting anyone take your manhood. And when my grandfather was able to stop sharecropping, he did. And he always said, I thank God I never had a bad harvest. But I think my uncle saw that and realized just because I can doesn't mean I should do other people wrong, that I can take care of my family and let other people take care of their families with dignity and have enough and leave enough for other people on the table. Because capitalism says, take as much as you can. But my uncle said, I'm going to take as much as I need and I'm going to make sure other people have what they need. And we can all be good. We can all be okay. And I think that's a really important thing. And of course, my uncle's in his, you know, he's in his late 70s now. He's retired. But that was an important life lesson. Because we don't have to hoard it all for ourselves just because we can.
Richard.
Yes. Dr. Carter, I'm glad that you did this work. It helped me. I'll tell you, from the first time I heard this conflicted nativism, I've been throwing it around. It's a hook, you know, and I'm a fisherman. And it's just interesting how people respond to it. You know, they understand Du Bois, you know, double consciousness and all that. But when they hear that and they're saying like, you are this American, but at the same time, you know, the tension. So it's helpful. It's a helpful framework, you know, to continue this dialogue. And I'm just glad that you did the work.
Well, thank you so much for reading it.
Not that I'm going to, you know, go broke getting all these books and probably can't read them anyway, but I can appreciate it.
Well, thank you so. You all are part of the reason why I love Philly and miss it so much. Philly is my favorite city, I must confess. And part of the reason why I love Philly so much and enjoy Philly so much, one, because Philly people are straight up, they're going to tell you what they think, but they are also some of the best people you will ever meet. And one thing I will say about that city, people there are curious and want knowledge and want to know things. And that really spoke to me as a young person in that city. Mm. How many people you could meet that had read something interesting or told you something new that you hadn't thought about. So I just really appreciate you all for inviting me and having this conversation. It was great.
A couple of things before you go, Doctor, because I know you got a book coming out, or you're working on it. And also, because I'd like to get you back on. You were on and I'm looking at this thing right in front of me now. It's titled Africa and America 2021, Re-envisioning Liberation for the Global Black Diaspora. And I just wanted to know, because I'd seen some of the people that you were involved with or that was involved with you. Well, I guess it was a collaboration. I just wanted to know a little bit more about that. Maybe we can get you back on to talk a little bit about what you were talking about there. I think our people starting to look at geopolitical situations, seeing what's going on in the continent, seeing some of the people that's coming here from the continent that have been espousing us looking at one another as brethren and working together. I think those things are a vision for us to look forward to as a people. So I just wanted to kind of get you back on to kind of get your, to kind of pick your brain in reference to that work that you were doing in reference to the global Black diaspora.
Well, I sure would love to. And again, thank you both for being such
such great hosts and for having such amazing questions. Give me hard questions today. But this has been a really great conversation. I really appreciate you both.
We'll talk to you soon. And I'm sorry for that little snafu there. I don't know what happened. Maybe.
Oh, no problem. It happens sometimes, but the show goes on.
COINTELPRO still works.
Thank you for being with us. Talk to you soon.
Thank you. Have a good evening.
All right. We'll be right back.
With host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road.